Have you got an example like this, which comes from mathematics? So we stop hitting Dennis with telescopes, maybe?
Welcome to our next episode of About Logic. And I'm super happy that we have two guests, and these two guests are doing lovely stuff, namely Bernhard Fiseni and Bernhard Schröder from the University of Duisburg-Essen, and both work for quite a while on the language of mathematics. And as we will see, this topic has like many intersections with other themes that we already had in our podcast, like theory improving software, foundations of mathematics. So thank you very much for joining.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.
Yeah, let me start with a very naive question. Would you be willing to give us like a 1-2 minute upshot of your research areas? What are you working on right now? How would you summarize that for our audience?
I think we have been working on how to apply the concept of frames, which is a very broad concept or a concept with many facets, to the language of mathematics for some time now. Before that, in my master's thesis, I tried to develop an annotation language for mathematical language, which has some connections to what we are doing now. I think that is not a minute, but maybe a start of what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think we will talk more about frames in a minute, in another minute. So maybe let me hand over to Bernhard Schröder first.
Yes, I can just add that we are working within the framework of frames when we look at the language of mathematics. The project in which this research is embedded is the NAPOSH project, which started in 2003, I think. And it started from looking at the language of mathematics together with some logicians at the University of Bonn, and we talked about some peculiarities of the language of mathematics. And from a linguistic viewpoint, I had the impression that we could explain these peculiarities very good within the semantics of natural language, especially with the dynamic approaches to semantics, like dynamic predicate logic and discourse representation theory. And that was the start of the project. And then in the first phase, we developed a controlled natural language in which mathematical proofs could be written, at least basic proofs at first, and then later we moved to other topics which looked at the more pragmatic structure of proofs, and this led to the occupation with frames.
Can I ask this a very general question? So why are we interested in the language of mathematics?
I think we could give two answers to this, one from a linguistic viewpoint and one from the viewpoint, I think, of formal mathematics. I'm not an expert in the last field, but maybe I could say more from the linguistic viewpoint. From the linguistic viewpoint, proof texts are texts, and texts of a very special kind, texts which we know what they should mean, and we know that quite precisely. And therefore, from a semantic viewpoint, we can learn very much from this text type how certain semantic structures are communicated.
And maybe could add that the formal approaches to language and linguistics sometimes make presuppositions which are especially true of what mathematical texts want to convey, namely that they want to have a very clear and accurate semantics, which is not so much true maybe in spoken language or in everyday use of language, but is, as you will probably agree, true of much of mathematical discourse.
So it's an area where which is sort of easier in a way than other. I mean, if there's lots of sort of everyday knowledge involved, then it may be more difficult to say what actually the meaning should be, right? So
it's easier, it's more unambiguous. That is an important feature. And
it's maybe closer in some assumptions to the formal approaches sometimes come from a mathematical background. And therefore, it's maybe not so surprising that they fit more to mathematical discourse than they fit to everyday language.
Yes.
Nevertheless, we find all pragmatic phenomena we know from other sorts of texts, also in the proof texts.
Mm-hmm. Can you give some examples? I mean, what sort of phenomena we are looking at?
For example, ambiguity is also present in mathematical texts. Implications, implicatures, non-logical implications from assumptions, what is relevant in a text can be seen in mathematical texts too. All strategies of resolving ambiguities in texts. Yeah. Also, the way things are told, walls are kept small. All these strategies can be also seen in mathematical texts.
Which is, I just thought, this part of ambiguity, or actually this intentional ambiguity, because often we don't want to complicate our expressions. So we overload, the same terms have lots of different meaning. Policing, so this is also something which plays a role in formal mathematics. I mean, in computer formalization, it's not. As you say, the formal languages are sort of an idealization of the informal languages. So yeah, so that is an interesting tension here, right? Have you looked at how formal mathematics deals, or like tools, how they deal with these issues?
Yes, in the sort they avoid it. So they avoid ambiguities and they avoid many pragmatic phenomena.
Actually, they don't. They don't avoid ambiguity. The ambiguity is absolutely essential to have a concise expression. And there is lots of work in how to dissolve ambiguity in formal mathematical text. So it's actually, I think the formal mathematics is actually closer to the informal text than you think. Suggested, maybe. I shouldn't imply, yeah.
What kinds of ambiguities are you thinking of? So ambiguities, I think for us, ambiguities would be something that cannot be absolutely resolved in context.
Yes, so they can be resolved, but the process, I mean, for example, I write, for example, type coercions. I have an object of a certain type, but I need an object of another type. And now I say, whenever you see an integer and you need a real number, then automatically coerces. But this is actually ambiguous. It could be another way. I mean, there's mismatch and it has to be resolved. And there are lots of assumptions in even formal mathematics, which make it possible to write things without too many sort of complicated annotation. So, for example, if I talk about numbers, I say for all x, and x plus 1 equals y, and now we know that x is quantified over, for example, natural numbers, but this is an ambiguity because plus is also overloaded. So there has to be, there is a resolution mechanism. There's often more than one way to resolve these ambiguities, also in the formal text, right? And there is...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. But in a formal context, you rely on that there is an algorithm which resolves the ambiguity in a in a uniform way, right?
So, I mean, this is arguable whether this is uniform. I mean, that's exactly the question. Yeah? So I'm just saying it's a research area in formal mathematics, I mean, in implementations of proof tools. There's lots of work in trying exactly to do. It just reminded me, I mean, that this issue of ambiguity, overloading polyseme expressions, which you identified is an issue in informal mathematics, actually is also an issue in formal mathematics.
Yes, but I would say that the typical examples of ambiguity in natural language are those that are not easily resolvable. I mean, you can get a good idea about what is probably intended, but if you have one of the typical sentences is Dennis hit the mathematician with a telescope. And now we don't know whether the mathematician has a Dennis telescope or Dennis has a telescope. And the hitting was, and the telescope is an instrument of hitting on, and so on. And I think in a mathematical language, or in a formal language that is compiled in the end, there must be one meaning that comes out of the interpretation that is normally ensured by compilers or so, or you will, the sentence will not be acceptable. But in natural language, we very often just proceed with probabilities. We think Dennis is a kind person. He won't hit someone with a telescope, so it's probable that the other person has a telescope, and this helps to identify the person that was hit.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's
but I think we are already in the second half of the reply, right? This is already what the formal mathematician can learn from linguistic work to some degree, because some of these techniques of making things unambiguous might be better informed from how natural mathematical texts are passed, right? So in some sense, we jumped a little bit ahead. But I didn't want to interrupt, Thorsten. You had another question there?
Yeah, I mean, this example is certainly a parsing problem, right? I mean, how to turn an expression into a tree. And in informal mathematics, that's often done by assigning binding strengths to operators, right? But you're suggesting in natural language, this is just done by plausibility, right? But to what degree is this? I mean, there's an issue of associativity, and which can be resolved. I mean, there are two different parse trees, which are not clearly explained which one is meant. And you say to choose between these two different parse trees, you just look in the semantics. And based on the semantics, you choose a more plausible interpretation, right?
I think that would be an answer of a formal linguist. Mm-hmm. Maybe psycholinguists would say something different about whether you, in a certain context, you just expect. For instance, if you have seen Dennis before with a telescope, you might get to have a different expectation and expect a different syntactic, where we would probably say frame for this sentence. Or if you have heard very similar sentences which had a very determinate meaning, with was always used to designate the instrument, then you would probably expect that with encodes the instrument in this sentence, and that would change your expectation. We can discuss whether these are pragmatic or semantic issues only.
Mm-hmm. Have you got an example like this, which comes from mathematics? So we stop hitting Dennis with telescopes, maybe?
So one type of ambiguity, which is quite everywhere in mathematical texts, are scope ambiguities, like how far does the scope of a certain assumption go? Or another type of ambiguity is a syntactic ambiguity. you have sentences like for any A and B, such that some C and D is valid, something is true, and this such that attribute can be applied to A and B or just to B. And these are quite typical cases of ambiguity, which are everywhere in mathematical texts.
Mm-hmm. So to get back to my point, so these ambiguities, first of all, also exist in formal mathematics, but they are then often resolved in a way which is also applied to programming languages, right? That we have.
Mm-hmm.
So different operators have certain binding strengths, and as a result, we disambiguate. But you are saying that in mathematics, it's more done on a soft level based on the meaning. What is a more plausible interpretation, mm-hmm. right?
Right,
so
yes.
That's the difference between formal and informal mathematics, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, and in this case, as in both cases, let's say missing bracketing strategies in natural language are the cause. And mm-hmm. of course, you can try to introduce control the interpretation of such expressions, but if you want to do it very universally, the costs are quite high, as you can see in controlled natural languages.
I see. Because you don't really use brackets in natural language, right?
Right.
But in formal mathematics, you can just use brackets. But brackets are not very popular because they make it more difficult to read the text, right?
Yeah. Mm. And
you can use something like brackets, maybe if you say quotation, starting, quotation, ending, and then you know that something is a quotation and has to be interpreted in a different context.
I find actually when you do spoken mathematics, like if you give a lecture, you can use the pause and how much time, the timing to express exactly the scope issues, mm-hmm. right? But obviously the techniques in written mathematics are obviously different. So you're saying it's the one way is to just go what is a more plausible interpretation, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Are there other ways to resolve these ambiguities? I
tried to indicate that plausibility can mean different things, right? If you have, for instance, if you have German compounds or so, you can trigger different interpretations by providing a different context. And I think you can do that in mathematics as well. But I think it also works in English. If you talk about a chicken steak and a cow steak and then a children's steak, then you will start to laugh. If you talk about things that are for people before, give it a context where it's clear that this is normally, if you read it on a menu, you will not laugh about that too much, right? You may be aware of the ambiguity because you like playing with language, but most people just don't care. And similarly, if you have established that A always refers to a certain kind of variable and you use or parameter or whatever, and you use it again, then you will probably take the last expectation and not what is maybe for someone who's not in this field the most prominent use out of context.
So there's certainly a sort of context dependency of this process, right? So
yes, but of course context can mean very different things. Context can be a syntactic context. Context can be something like something must be consistent in a very narrow context, or context can mean something very holistic in a text. Mm-hmm. Context can explain everything, so because it's a very ambiguous and weak concept.
So maybe let's talk about one particular thing that might be context and which you worked a lot about, namely frames, right? The background knowledge that helps us to enrich what's actually written in there. Would you be willing to give us a rough idea about that, especially since it's also artificial intelligence, right? As so many things, but in another kind of AI, I guess.
Yeah, it's an old-fashioned kind of AI that nobody wants to have anything to do with at the moment, probably.
It will come back. There will be another winter of the newer methods, and then I don't know.
There is maybe also a link to the modern AI in the sense that we assume that frames are learned, so that you learn certain about certain situations and develop expectations about them. And of course, that we may hope that machines also learn something like frames in the end.
So, they do already, actually.
The idea would be that for instance, if we know about a podcast, we know there are some hosts and some guests, or maybe just one of them. And maybe if we know it's a podcast about logic, we also have some specific expectations about the kinds of guests that might be there, and that maybe would be constitute a frame of already. And then we talked in the beginning whether that podcast could be with video or could just be audio as in earlier times, and that would be different kinds of podcasts, and you could cross-classify this with video logic podcasts and video non-logic podcasts and so on. You know how to do that. We think that talking about mathematics works in a similar way, with expectations about what is done at a certain moment in a certain proof for pattern, for instance.
It's interesting because actually the new, I mean, the AI on which these large language models are based is actually doing something like this. But the frames are not pre-programmed. They actually learned. So they discover certain structures in text and also in the current context and learn then exactly something which is frames. But the frames are not, I mean, these frames are not prescribed. They're not put in. They're actually learned by the tool. I mean, maybe interesting to look at the relation between this frame concept from the old AI and this context-dependent learning, which is implemented in modern AI or in large language models.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think all I know about the frames in the newer AI models is that they are in some sense quite flat, and the frames which we talk about in the context of mathematical texts are quite rich structures, which also come from the fact that they are designed manually and not just learned from text. I think there are aspects of such frames which at least at the moment hardly can be learned from text, because they are not very explicit in the text themselves. What the machines learn,
So maybe if we assume that there is we stay with the podcast example, that you have guests in a logic podcast, you could model the podcast having a subject and people having an area of research, and you could then say normally podcasts have people, or scientific podcasts have people where the area of research matches the theme of the podcast in some sense. And that would be a kind of deep modeling, because you wouldn't say the first thing you think about for people is that they have an area of research or so, that maybe is somewhere in their professional competence and then in a specific kind only makes only sense for people who are working in academia, maybe, and so on. And then for podcasts, you might get into a similarly layered structure of what makes them up. And I think that that is not explicit in texts normally.
Yeah, it's not implicit in one text, but if you look at lots of texts, and you can discover, I mean, like humans can discover this. It seems to be, I mean, so nobody understands exactly what these LLMs are doing. So that's a fundamental difference to what you're doing. You know what you're doing. But they are surprisingly, they discover surprisingly deep structures when you start playing around with them.
And so how would this frame project for mathematical text look like? And again, maybe anticipating a question of Torsten, and why would somebody do that? What's the usage of them?
Yes, I think for us, if we are dealing with mathematical texts and try to understand how these texts are structured, the frame approach helps us to fill gaps in the text and to helps us to get things into a structure which can be interpreted. For example, we have looked at induction proofs, and in these proofs, some steps which you would expect in a normal induction proofs are just not mentioned. They do not appear and are left to the reader. In order to make sense of this whole proof and to reconstruct its logical structure, we have to reconstruct these missing statements in the proof, these missing information. And we think that frames could be a good tool to do that. Yeah, Bernard.
I was just, because you asked how the project looks, so what it looks like has maybe some, if you want a general picture, linguists try to work with bases of texts. I think Bernard has already presupposed this in what he said. So the project could start, and that's what we are planning at the moment, to by collecting texts and pre-processing them in a way that we can discover frames and can look for what parts of frames are realized and are not realized, and can then build up knowledge about how frames are used in mathematical texts. That linguists call that a corpus, but people call lots of things corpora at the moment. So maybe you have already heard the term.
If you don't have anything to say more about frames, I would open maybe a third and maybe final bunch of topics. And I think that's one of these narratology perspectives on mathematical texts. So there used to be a philosophical tradition saying math is just writing stories. And so writing proof text is just writing a story. And then there are some people who say, never do say that, and others still like that idea. What kind of associations is this bringing to you as linguists, as narratologists?
Yes, we can, of course, look at the structure of mathematical texts from the viewpoint of a story. And also the frame approach may contribute to this view, because what has to be told is something which helps to identify the frame, and then to fill the gaps which are not given by the frame. That's the important part of the story. I think one could look at from this viewpoint to mathematical proofs. Another viewpoint could be what is it what is told in a mathematical proofs. A proof, and when two proofs are instant, or the proof texts are instances of the same proof, and we have also thought about this. Maybe Bernard could say more about this aspect of the story.
Yeah, but maybe it's not clear why this is related to narratology also, but the same question can arise when you talk about, for instance, a film and a book or two versions of a story or a novel or whatever, a play, and try to find out whether they have the same, whether they are the same in some sense. And then I think the first thing that you will say is they are obviously the same and they are not. And then you can start to discuss what kinds of identities are or similarities are relevant. And similarly, probably you can do that about mathematical texts. So does it make it, if two proofs omit different details, are they still the same? Can they still be the same proof? And I'm not sure, probably as we, as with narrative literature, that you can give a definitive answer on that question, but you can develop maybe interesting ways of looking at the question by that. And we have tried to work out in what sense this can be similar to models employed in the study of narrative literature, for instance.
And I think a further aspect of this storytelling approach is to look at how the discourse entities in mathematical texts are managed. So mathematical texts are talking about huge discourse universes, you know, with non-finite set and so on. But they have to do it in a way that they address a manageable sets of discourse, let's say discourse reference. So distinguishable objects which are referred to. So, for example, if you talk about all numbers n, in this moment you just talk about one object which you look at and which you treat in your text. And the objects which are introduced in mathematical texts are highly related to each other. They are grouped in complexes, and that helps to keep the set of discourse reference, so things which are referred to, quite small in mathematical texts and much smaller than in most other types of texts.
So this is these dynamical approaches you mentioned in the very beginning, like could model something like that, adding whatever we talk about.
Yes. Actually, I was just wondering about one thing. So often I find about proofs, they are difficult to just tell. You have to do them yourself, basically. And often proof texts are just sort of give enough hints for the reader, depending on the level of the reader, to be able to do the proof, right, themselves. Because you cannot actually, I think you cannot just read the proof, or that's maybe not the preferred way to deal with it. And also, so the, maybe that has to do with frames, that you can leave out lots of things in a proof, because all you want to give is enough hint for the reader to say, you see, our proof is by induction similar to theorem such and such. Yeah. So instead, because as I say, it's very difficult to read proofs, or I would say virtually impossible. What you need to do is you need to execute the proof, and using some soft hints which you get from the text. Does this play a role in your work? Or?
Yes, I think if you are able to do the proof, then you have a frame how to how you can do it, and you need the necessary hints to fill in the gaps. Yeah,
the gaps.
I think that and I think another technique is of course analogy. That you, as you mentioned, that someone says this is quite analogous to that proof.
Yeah.
so that you can follow the same path to do the proof.
Okay.
It's also, I think, one of the points where formalizing becomes most difficult, because most formalisms I know of just use a kind of comment in this place is similar to that proof, and then you still have to model all the details yourself. And humans seem to be able to make sense of these comments in a much more broad way to trigger the right frames. Maybe you know better formalisms, Thorsten, but once
I don't know better formalisms, but I'm using ChatGPT, and it's quite good to do this kind of thing, so astonishingly. Or any LLM, sorry, I should mention a number of them.
Maybe one and another association about this story approach is that there is a lot of framing now in slightly different sense of the word frame of proof. Like, even if the objective level, if we want to speak like that, the facts are clear, sometimes you can motivate a lot by switching your perspective on the area. You could see something as something, the Wittgensteinian in me would like to say. So you can craft how the audience can understand what's given in a little different text. And sometimes this is quite the revolution in mathematics, right? If we read Laudatio's for the Fields Medal, we often see something like person X was the first to frame area Z in terms of area Y, even if it's not changing the facts, right? It's just a different way of writing things down, so to speak. But that's a highly productive motor of innovation in math. What do you think about that? Is that perspective used proper, like the narratologist would use, or would a narratologist not use perspective?
It's difficult to now find the parallels, right? Maybe you can talk about cases for epistemic relationships or so. So if something that is told from the perspective of a child, and you have to kind of unpack this to understand, for instance, why this is a horrible event and the child doesn't even understand that, that might be this a transfer of perspective that is necessary for interpreting texts. For the rest, it may be more similar to different kinds of media or different kinds of texts dealing with the same event or the same story. I'm not sure this would be called a perspective in narratology. I think that there's, within our frameworks, it makes sense to call it a perspective, but I think that's not what you would think of probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what you call perspective has very much to do with the shift of frames. That you see some object as an instance of a certain frame, and then look at the same object as an instance of another frame, and get new relations, new techniques, argumentative techniques, and so on with a new frame.
So maybe it's closer to some theories of metaphor also than to what is traditionally called perspective.
Okay, I see we are around our regular time limit for these episodes, but I still would invite you, has anybody still a pressing issue or want to talk about a new project, wants to advertise something, then this would be an opportunity.
I was just thinking about a point that Thorsten made about that you have to do proofs. And I think that is an interesting point when we speak about this narratological modeling, that there you normally don't, you talk about worlds where something changes, and doing a proof also applies some changes, while normally mathematical texts are special in that the world does not change in these proofs, but it you describe as most people claim eternal truths, right? So, sorry, this is not a new point, but I just...
No, that's right in the heart of a repeating discussion within about logic, right? So there are different perspectives on math. Thorsten would...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much it's related, but to me, mathematics is all about, as you say, telling stories. And it's not about the real world, because it's constructions we do in our head. And this forces me, suggests to me that I adopt a more constructive foundation where the notion of truth is rather difficult, because as the notion of truth is difficult in a story, because certain things are not said. I mean, for example, whether Captain Ahab had a blue shirt in Moby Dick, it's not mentioned. Yeah. So in a way, this idea that mathematics is really a particular kind of storytelling is important for the foundations of constructive mathematics. And indeed, if you look at how constructive mathematics is mathematically modeled, namely by Kripke structures and Bethe models, exactly these are the structures of stories. I mean, this is explained. What, for example, this implication in a story is, you know that P implies Q. If you later find out that P holds and Q holds, even in the moment, you have no way to establish this. So there is this relation. But I don't know whether that relates to what you're doing.
And maybe in some sense, mathematical texts do not tell what you actually do, but what you can do, or in some hypothetical sense could do, because you rely in some parts of this proof that you could do that, but you never do that.
Sure. Yes. So, but also these are constructions in your head, right? I mean, they don't exist in the real world. I mean, unless you're a hardcore Platonist, they're really things we have invented. We have invented mathematics. We have not discovered it. So that's the punchline.
But I think this even works in classical math and to quite some degree, and at least the language looks like that, right? There's this work on the tetric phrase, it is, Bernhard, I'm not sure. Sei eine Gruppe, so let this
static,
be that.
We call it static phrase, yeah.
Sure.
Right.
So it's like an illocutionary act, is it that? you say something into existing, and even if maybe the Platonist wouldn't say, okay, you really built a triangle and now it's there and it wasn't there before, our proof could very well say, do the circle around point A and one around C, and they intersect in points B and D. And so our speaking about math is quite often more constructive, more temporal, more story-like than the logical reconstruction, where we just go to the deductive hole and get every statement following from the axiom in an instant. So I think this is a productive endeavor even for classical math, and especially in math education, because their understanding without doing is something students wish for, but unfortunately that doesn't happen, right?
Yeah, and interestingly, Mrs. Constructor's U is built into the Euclidean approach to proofs. He has this construction phase in his proofs, the way he constructs some objects and then derives some claims from this. And interestingly, this thetic phrase is often verbalized in Euclidean proofs in the Greek texts by an imperative of the third person. So there is an order to whoever to let something be something.
So it's maybe interesting. From what you said, or if you combine this, so on the one hand there is storytelling, and storytelling can be done by reading a book, but actually proofs are maybe more like acting, you know. I mean, where you act a play, and instead of just reading it, right? So that's was of this idea of that you have to do a proof, you act it. And that also relates to maybe what you just mentioned about the Greek text.
Yeah, maybe there are some similarities to cooking receipts or something like that in some sense.
But you can, is it the complexity that makes it possible to read cooking recipes but not proofs? I mean, at least I would claim you can read a cooking recipe and get an idea of what happens. You probably don't know what it tastes like in detail, but you get an idea of what you have to do.
But again, this is, I think it's related to this background knowledge, right? As a seasoned mathematician, to stay with the cooking recipes, would have some estimates what could happen even without doing the proof. We would, like, if the well-known professor says, just use something like that, and I don't know the details, but it will work out somehow, and to fill in the details is a PhD student's task. I think this is very usual in math.
But I think the same applies to recipes, because if you're not very good, not very experienced with cooking, you will do this, follow this recipe step by step. But if you've done a number of recipes, if you cooked already, then you just browse through it and say, here I have to watch, because that's the interesting bit, yeah. And you're not really following step by step, but you still can do the recipe and actually interpret it maybe in a creative way, have slightly different version, which is also true for proofs. Yeah, once you play a proof, it may end up to be something slightly different to what you've seen before.
Yeah, I think a difference to plays is that there's normally just one actor, so it would be. Right, you manage everything in a proof. Normally, it's not that the triangle does something, or the circle, the compass, or whatever.
I mean, there's this idea of using the sort of dialogues to model quantifier nesting, right? So if you try to understand how, for example, an application of the pumping lemma works. These are often, and this is also a formal way to understand a logical system, by actually having dialogues instead of just one person acting. So that's actually does play a role.
Yeah, but then it would be two people talking about what is done, it wouldn't be the mathematical objects that do something. That was
the point
I was trying to make. But in a play, it's actors doing something, and the fact of acting would be, and the actors are more like the objects of the story, which would be the mathematical objects, right?
I think maybe this analogy is a bit tricky here.
I think the cooking recipe works a bit better, or maybe playing with puppets or something like that.
But we should not forget that there are, of course, important differences between recipes and proofs, because recipe is a directive speech act. So you have imperatives and so on. Mathematical proofs also seems to tell about facts. So it's an assertive speech act in most parts of it. Only the assumptions are usually communicated with directive speech acts.
Okay, that's another interesting story, to use yet another word. But let me ask Thorsten and Bernhard, do you have something which you wanted to bring up or to deepen that's mentioned in our discussion?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, I'm fine too, I think.
Then I guess it's time to thank you. I will add the frame text in the comment section, and as also something on the dialogical approach to proofs by Katharina, a lovely book that won the Lakatos Award, and any other papers that we mentioned that I try to add them there. And then I can say thank you very much for being here. It was an interesting talk.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us. Yeah.
Cool. Then, great. And let I say to the audience, as always, don't forget to subscribe and comment and discuss. We hope to have in the comment section a more or less productive exchange. And see you in 2 weeks. And bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.